This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I think we got everybody. Did we miss somebody? No, we got Jerome. Yeah. All right, welcome. I've got a few people joining us remotely as well. Thank you for joining us. So I'm Dan. I'm Dan Zygmunt. I'm one of the guiding teachers here at Jikoji. I've been practicing here a long time. I was ordained here in 1998. I'll talk a little bit, and then we'll open things up for questions. And then afterwards, if you'd like, you're all welcome to join us for lunch. I was thinking a little bit about the chant we did, the Heart Sutra. It's one of the shortest sutras. A sutra is one of the lectures the Buddha gave, and there's several hundred of them. A collection of all the sutras would take pretty much a whole shelf of a bookshelf. The Heart Sutra is one of the shortest, and it's traditionally chanted in Zen monasteries every morning. And it has this line about attaining unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. As I said, these sutras are lectures the Buddha gave. And any discussion of enlightenment really has to start with Buddha. Because Buddha, it's not a name, it's a title. The Buddha's name was Siddhartha Gautama. And he earned that title, Buddha, which just means the awakened one, the one who is awake. When he had his great realization, his experience of enlightenment. And so in a very real sense, there can be no Buddhism without Buddha, and there's no Buddha without enlightenment, without awakening, without that experience that he had about 2,500 years ago. As I said, Buddha was born an ordinary person. He was born to a royal family in what is now Nepal, eventually lived in what's now India. And being part of this royal family, being a prince, he lived a very pampered life. When he was born, his father had brought in a soothsayer, a fortune teller, to predict the fortune of this young child, and the soothsayer predicted that the child would follow one of two paths, either become a great leader, like his father, a king, or become a great spiritual teacher. And his parents very much preferred the first path. They wanted him to become a king, to be royalty like them. And they sensed that probably what would cause him to follow a spiritual path was some experience of suffering, was hardship. And I think that's even true today. What often brings people to a temple like this, to meditation, is some dissatisfaction, something in their life that feels out of balance, that feels not quite right. One of my earliest Zen teachers, I think it was Blanche, was one of the first, I think she was the first female abbot at the San Francisco Zen Center. This was before she was even an abbot. She used to say that you wouldn't meet very many happy people in a Zendo. It's a little harsh. I mean, I think some of us are happy enough. but that people often come because there's some unhappiness. There's something that's bothering them. So Buddha's parents, despite no particular spiritual training, I think somehow they intuited this, that if they wanted him to become a king and not to get distracted by spiritual matters, that they needed to keep him happy. And so they did everything they could to keep him happy and to shelter him from anything that might make him unhappy. So they built these three incredible palaces for the three different seasons in that part of India. they hired all these musicians and dancers to entertain. This was before screens and things, so you had to hire people to do entertainment. And it said that they even posted guards at the gates of the palace, who were instructed not to let any unhappy people in the door. So he would literally have no experience of unhappiness of himself or anyone else. And if you are a parent, or maybe if you just remember your own childhood, I think maybe you can identify a little with this impulse of wanting to shelter kids from anything difficult, anything that might make them unhappy. And maybe you also recognize that that can work for a little while. You actually can shelter your kids to an extent, but it can't work forever. Eventually, the world finds its way in. And that started to happen to Buddha as well. As he got into his teenage years, and even a little beyond, he just had this nagging feeling that there was more to life than what his parents were showing him, than just messing around in the palace. And so he convinced one of his many servants to help him sneak away one night. And so one night, after everyone was asleep, the two of them snuck away and went into the nearby village. And in that village, he encountered what we call the three sights. First, someone who was very sick, begging on the side of the road. And Buddha had never seen anyone in that state. Then somebody who was very old and who was struggling to walk, walking with a cane. Buddha had never seen anyone like that either. And then finally, a funeral procession went by bearing a corpse. And Buddha saw someone who was dead, and he had never encountered death before. And he sensed right away that these three great hardships, sickness, old age, and death, awaited all of us. And knowing that, it just seemed impossible to go back to this life of fun and games, knowing that it was all going to eventually lead to sickness, old age, and death, regardless. And he decided he had to do something different. He had to somehow understand how to overcome this great suffering that awaited us all. And at that point, he saw the fourth sight. He saw a wandering holy man, as was common in India in those days, and as you still see today, who had shaved his head and dressed in rags and was just wandering around doing various spiritual practices. And Buddha decided that was the path for him, that he would leave the royal life and live like a wandering ascetic. So he and his servant went back to the palace just one last time. Buddha cut off his hair, got rid of his royal clothes, and just disappeared into the Indian countryside. And then, having rejected this life that his parents built for him and intended for him, he decided he would try the exact opposite. Instead of living a life of comfort and ease, he would live a life of extreme hardship, as much hardship as he could possibly endure. And he began wandering around India looking for teachers who would instruct him in these ascetic practices, extreme fasting, living for days and days on a single grain of rice, holding his breath for so long that his skin would turn black and he would nearly pass out, and just pushing himself to the absolute limit of his endurance. And after doing this for several years, he realized that he really was at his limit, and that if he continued torturing himself in this way, he was just going to die. And that instead of teaching him how to overcome suffering, all he was doing was suffering more. And that if he didn't stop, he would, as I said, die no closer to understanding the root of all this suffering than before when he started. At that point, it said a young woman passed by who had been milking cows and had a bucket of milk, and seeing his pathetic figure on the side of the road, she offered him some. She accepted. And that gave him enough strength to try something different. What he decided to try was meditation, what we've been doing this morning. He found a quiet spot, not a temple like this, but a quiet spot outside, sheltered by a tree, what we now call the Bodhi tree, the enlightenment tree. And he vowed to sit under that tree in meditation until he had his answer. And so he sat all the rest of that day, all through the night. And just before dawn, as the morning star rose, he had his great awakening and became the Buddha. The awakening is hard to describe, and in fact, at first, Buddha had no interest in trying to describe it in becoming a teacher. He just thought most people wouldn't understand. That would be frustrating. Why set himself up for that frustration? If people wanted to find awakening, they could just find it themselves. But he was eventually convinced that he should try to teach, that even though he had found awakening, realized awakening on his own, it would be much easier if people got some instruction, some hints. After all, he had wasted lots of time on these other practices that hadn't helped him at all. So he could save people a lot of frustration, a lot of trouble. And so he began to teach. And that's why we have these sutras. And in his very first lecture, he gave in what's usually called the deer park, which was just a little clearing that was frequented by deer, probably very similar to the area here. We get a lot of deer here too. So probably just a little clearing in the woods outside of a village. Again, similar to where we are. And the students, his first students, were people he had been practicing these ascetic practices with, people he had been fasting and so forth with. And they were actually very skeptical at first. They could tell just by looking at him that he had stopped fasting, that he, had this milk and had more energy. And so at first they sort of thought he had gone soft, and they were skeptical that he would have anything to teach. But he won them over. And he won them over with this pretty simple message that living a life of extremes just doesn't work. That either the life he was living with his parents, of trying to avoid suffering at all cost, or the life he was living with these ascetics, of searching out suffering, trying to suffer as much as he possibly could, that neither of those got you anywhere. Neither of those really got to the root of suffering. And that the key was balance. The key was what he called the middle way. Not seeking out suffering, not running away from suffering. But simply living your life, dealing with suffering as it arises, but not hanging on to it. In a later lecture, he described suffering with this parable of someone who's walking down the road and gets struck by an arrow. That arrow is like the suffering that comes to all of us. Something bad happens. We get hurt. We lose something. And that's bad. But then for most of us, there's this experience a little bit like getting hit by a second arrow. And that second arrow is this whole narrative that we create around the suffering. Why did this happen to me? Why was someone so careless? Why did I decide to walk on this path instead of another path? And all the ways we sort of beat ourselves up about this suffering. And so those first arrows, Buddha taught, were unavoidable. Bad things will happen. Even if you try to run away from it, as his parents had tried, even if you try to shelter yourself, you can't ever shelter yourself from suffering. Eventually suffering, it finds us all. Whether that's sickness, old age, and death, or more mundane suffering of getting irritated with a friend or losing something in your apartment. Annoying things happen, and they just do. But we don't have to suffer about the suffering. These things happen, but in a funny way, they're not really happening to us. They're just happening. We might think it's so unfair that we suffer. But in fact, it's not unfair because everyone suffers. I sometimes tell people that Buddha's message is that there's nothing wrong with you. People find that sort of hard to believe, hard to accept. And so another way to put it, that maybe sometimes people find a little easier to accept, is that there's nothing uniquely wrong with you. The things that we don't like, the suffering we encounter, that happens to everybody. It's not because you did something wrong. It's not because you're a bad person. It just happens. Now, of course, living this middle way is difficult. When something painful happens, when we make a mistake. I had the experience actually just a couple days ago. I was moving some things in my apartment and I dropped two teacups that I really loved and they just shattered. And I couldn't believe, first of all, why was I trying to move two teacups at once? I just wished I could back up, do this over again and do them one at a time. And I probably wouldn't have dropped them. And then even the two teacups, why did I decide that the right place for them was the highest shelf instead of the lowest shelf? Because on the lowest shelf, they probably would have been fine, but getting them to the highest shelf, I just couldn't do it, they fell. So it was painful to lose those teacups, and it was hard not to immediately go into this narrative of all the things I did wrong to cause me to break these two teacups. But the practice of meditation, I think, helps us to notice these things when they happen. To notice, first of all, that nothing good comes of all that self-criticism. It doesn't bring the teacups back. It might be worth noting the simple mistake I made. I shouldn't have moved them two at a time, and I shouldn't have tried to put them on the top shelf. But having noticed that, I can let it go. Next time, I'll do it differently. But hanging on to it, dwelling on it, beating myself up over this, that accomplishes nothing. Not only does it not bring the teacups back, it doesn't particularly make it any less likely that I'll break the next set. All it does is make me suffer. And part of why we practice meditation, again, is to develop this skill of noticing. Noticing when we're adding to our own suffering, noticing these unhelpful thoughts and learning to let them go. When I was giving the meditation instruction, I talked about the fact that when we're sitting in meditation, perhaps bringing our attention to our breath, thoughts will arise. Sometimes happy thoughts, sometimes sad thoughts, sometimes thoughts of pain, pleasure. And there again, we're practicing this middle way. We're not trying to push these thoughts away, but we're also not dwelling on them. We just notice the thoughts, and then we go on to the next moment and experience whatever the next moment has to bring. Because the only way to find this middle way is to pay attention. And we learn to pay attention through this practice of meditation. Now, it's still sometimes hard to connect all this back to that phrase in the Heart Sutra, unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. And of course, we don't know exactly what the Buddha experienced in his moment of realization. But I like to think that this experience of awakening is this experience of feeling that at least in that one moment, we're living our life in perfect balance. We are completely present. We're fully aware. We're fully awake. We can think of our consciousness as this kind of, unlike a spectrum. So you can imagine you've got this spectrum and you've got a point on the spectrum, which is just maybe how most of us are feeling right now, just awake, normally awake, how we spend most of our days. That's one point. You can imagine a point over here, which is what it's like to be asleep, just normally asleep. So we've got sleep, awake. Then I think we've all had some experiences in the middle. Maybe as you're falling asleep, but you're not quite asleep, you're sort of half asleep. If you don't do anything, you'll probably just fall asleep, and so then you'll move over this way. But if someone were to say your name, Dan, then you might like wake up. You're not really asleep yet. Maybe your eyes aren't even closed. Maybe you're having some thoughts, but the thoughts are getting a little confused. So that's sort of, you know, half asleep. And then there's another point that maybe we sometimes experience at work, at school, or even just in our other parts of our daily lives where we're sort of spacing out a little bit. We're awake, we're definitely not asleep, but we're also not really aware. People sometimes even have it while driving, where you're driving somewhere and you realize you have no idea how you got to where you are. Those like last 5 minutes are just gone. So sort of awake, but only really like half awake. And again, someone were to call your name, and when we're driving, like if a car pulled out in front of you, you might like suddenly wake up and do the right thing. But you're still somehow not quite there. You've got awake, half asleep, sleep. It's kind of the normal spectrum there. But you can also imagine, and maybe even have experienced, what it's like to be sort of even less conscious than asleep. Because even when we're asleep, if somebody, you know, shook you or called your name, you might wake up. You'd be really deeply asleep, where it would actually be really, quite hard to wake you up. So that might be, you know, over here. And then you could be like really unconscious, like in a coma, where you can't really be woken up. You're there, something's happening, there's brain activity, it can be measured with electrodes and things, but there's no waking you up. So like unconscious, deeply asleep, asleep, half awake. what happens if you like go the other direction? So it's easy to imagine being like more asleep than asleep. What's it like to be more awake than awake? What if you went half a step further along that spectrum? And I think for most of us, we've experienced that too. Maybe not very often. Maybe not recently. But where we've had some experience where we feel a little more alive, a little more awake. Maybe it's playing sports where you're just completely in the zone, feel like you just have this complete awareness of everything that's going on around you. Maybe it's at work where suddenly everything is coming together and you feel you understand everything in this one moment. Maybe it's falling in love where suddenly everything feels a little more real. People sometimes say colors seem brighter, sounds seem clearer. And then it passes. Sometimes it lasts for just a moment. Sometimes we're in that state for a little while, like maybe a whole game or a whole day at work. I think of that as the experience of awakening. This experience of being completely present, of being even more awake. There's disagreement about whether Buddha lived that experience all the time. Some people think he did, that, you know, as the awakened one, he was always, always awake. I'm not so sure. I think there are passages where he talks about when I'm experiencing awakening, then I feel this and that, which makes it sound like he wasn't always experiencing awakening, that there were times where he was and times that he wasn't. There's also times where he seems to get annoyed and acts in ways that, I don't know, don't seem hugely enlightened. So my sense is just he had more of those awakening experiences than most of us. As I said, for most of us, they're fleeting experiences that happen very rarely. Maybe he had them quite a bit, but that even he didn't have them all the time. And it's not totally clear what the connection is between meditation and those experiences. But in meditation, we are training our attention. We're training our awareness. So you could imagine having that training allows us to, or helps us be more awake. And so maybe brings on those experiences of complete awareness, complete awakening. But you could also imagine that maybe it just helps us notice those experiences more when they happen. That for many of us, you know, we might have that experience and it comes and it goes and we hardly even notice that we had it. But that through this training of attention, we notice. And we learn from it. But it's a bit of an act of faith. Our hope is that the attention that we train here is something we can take with us into the world. I often describe meditating in a temple like this as like learning how to drive. When you're first learning to drive, you go to an empty parking lot. Not because it's good to know how to drive in empty parking lots, but just because it's easier. You try to make it as easy for yourself as you can. You get rid of all the distractions, all the obstacles. And this is the same. It's really hard to pay attention out in the world with phones and cars and other people and jobs and classes and all kinds of things competing for your attention. So we get rid of all of that. You just sit facing a wall. In some ways, the least distracting environment you can imagine. It's quiet, light's not particularly bright. There's not a lot of colors. We often dress in these very subdued colors. And we just practice paying attention in the easiest environment we can imagine. But then we take that skill and we take it out into the world. It's just like you haven't really learned to drive until you've gone out onto the open road. No one would ever say they're a good driver if they've never been anywhere but an empty lot. Can't really say you know how to pay attention until you can do it out there. And awakening, if we find it, I think we probably find it out there. So that's why we're here, to continue this practice that Buddha did 2,500 years ago without any teachers, just under a tree, and to follow his example. Because I do think that is Buddha's great lesson, that awakening is possible. That although most of us inevitably live most of our lives sort of half asleep, not really paying attention, overcome with suffering, that it doesn't have to be that way. That it is possible to live differently. And so we follow that example, follow his practice. And endeavor to become Buddhas ourselves. People who come to my retreats and lectures, they often want to know if they have to become a Buddhist. And you know, the answer is no. In the Buddhist scriptures, there isn't even really a word for Buddhist. There's people who follow his teachings, there's people who follow his practices, but Buddha didn't care if anyone became a Buddhist. Buddha just wanted you to become Buddhas. We've got about 15 minutes. Maybe I'll pause there and see if there's any questions. Anything anyone would like to ask? You can ask me about what I was talking about, but you can ask me about something else too.
I was thinking about suffering, mm-hmm. and suffering being caused by bad things happening to you. And then I had a thought, because I'm feeling quite happy today, whether you can suffer because you're too happy.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I've ever suffered from being too happy. Buddha talked about three kinds of suffering. He used lots of lists, in part because when Buddha taught, that was not just before screens and, of course, before like tape recorders and things, but it was before paper. So people couldn't even take notes. They had to just remember what he said. And one way he helped people remember is to speak in lists. So Buddha scriptures are filled with lists. So talked about three kinds of suffering: not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and losing what you have. And I think the third one is sort of a risk that sometimes happens when you're feeling really happy. So you're feeling really happy, and that's great, and you're feeling good. And then this little voice comes in and says, boy, I don't want to lose this feeling. I want to have this feeling forever. And then you start thinking about losing this feeling, and you start really wanting, like, how can I make sure I never lose it, that I feel this way forever? Maybe, you know, I'm having this feeling and it's such a beautiful day. I want it always to be a beautiful day. Where can I move where it'll always be a beautiful day? Or I'm having this feeling because I just, you know, I'm spending time with this person. How can I always spend time with this person? I never want to lose that person. Anyways, we start to worry about how can I keep this forever? And one of Buddha's lectures, or actually several of them, but one of his teachings is that there is no forever, that nothing lasts forever. And that sort of grasping and wanting to hold on to things forever is one of the principal causes of suffering. And so I wouldn't say that being too happy itself causes suffering, but being too attached to happiness can cause us to suffer, because then we're not appreciating the happiness anymore. We're, you know, we're trying to build walls around it and preserve it. Being super happy in this moment is a wonderful gift. It's a wonderful thing. But we sort of enjoy that gift, and then we experience the next moment. And so I'm very glad that you're happy. But it's also okay not to be happy. And all of us in our lives will have moments of both.
I don't know if this is a question, but just the simple last couple of words you said in your talk, that Buddha didn't want us to be Buddhists, he wanted us to be Buddhas. It struck me as so, so deep and profound. And I'm not sure what my question is or not, but
I'll take it.
He's happy now.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if there's a question around it. I don't know, maybe if you want to say something more about it or not, but to me, that's the heart of why I come here, not to be a Buddhist.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I'm at least partly of two minds about it. I mean, here I am wearing these robes. I am a Buddhist. I do these rituals, these services. I'm one of the chief priests at a temple. I like being a Buddhist. I think I like it because it helps me feel connected to this long line of teachers that go back to Buddha. When you become a teacher in the Zen tradition, you sew this robe, this brown robe, and then you, after you've done that, and when you're sort of ready to kind of finish your training, you write out by hand these documents. And one of the documents, you write the name, you write your name, and you write your teacher's name, and you write their teacher's name, and then their teacher's name, and then their teacher's name, and you go all the way back to Buddha. So you trace this lineage of teachers. And you know, in some ways, not that many teachers. It's about 100 or so. Because it's only 2,500 years. And so I like feeling that connection to that lineage that goes all the way back. But But in a way, that's different than being a Buddha. Being a Buddha is to be an awakened one, to have that experience of awakening. And that's a potential in all of us, whether we put on robes or don't, whether we practice in a temple or not. Even in modern times, there are stories of people with spontaneous awakenings, with no spiritual training. They just have an awakening. So yeah, I like being a Buddhist and I like practicing in temples like this, but my sense is that Buddha himself would be a little skeptical and would want us to be a little more focused on just being Buddhist. Yes, please.
Was the Buddha's main focus on the practice of meditation, or was it on the Dharma teachings? Or was it a combination?
Yeah, you know, so many scriptures have come down to us. I talked about there being, you know, the filling of a full shelf. That's just the Pali scriptures, which are generally thought to be the oldest scriptures. But then there's the Sanskrit scriptures, which are, I don't know, like four more shelves, I mean, huge number. And then there's the Tibetan scriptures, which are like, I don't know, whole other room. there's a lot, a lot of scriptures that all claim to be teachings of the Buddha. And there are so many that I don't know that anyone actually can read them all. And in general, different sects of Buddhism have emerged that focus on different pieces. So there's something called the Lotus Sutra, and there's a whole school of Buddhism that just focuses on that one. We put a lot of emphasis on that Heart Sutra. There are all kinds of different Tibetan traditions that focus on different aspects of them. The term Zen Buddhism, Zen is the Japanese pronunciation of a Chinese term, Chan, and Chan is the Chinese pronunciation of a Sanskrit term, Dhyana, that means meditation. So, I don't know, 1,200, 1,500 years ago, there were already lots and lots of schools of Buddhism. And these monks in China decided, okay, we want to be the meditation school of Buddhism. So we're going to be the school of Buddhism that really focuses on meditation and tries to get all the way back to those basics. I mean, what was Buddhism, in some ways, what was Buddhism before Buddha? Before Buddha was awakened? Well, it was this guy sitting under a tree. So we're going to go back to that. That's going to be our version of Buddhism. And so we hardly read any scriptures. We have this one, it's one page long, super short. We have some ritual, but we really try to, you know, really go all the way back to the basics. Like diehard Zen Buddhists, like a true sectarian Zen Buddhist would say, yes, that's Buddha's true teaching, his original teaching. That's where he started, right? That's what he was doing before he was even Buddha. But I don't know. I think, you know, there's room for lots and lots of different practices. I know lots of people who practice in these other traditions. Somehow in recent years, I've met a lot of Tibetan Buddhists. I visited Tibet a few years ago, even in Japan. Zen is just one of many schools. There's these other schools, like I said, one that focuses on the Lotus Sutra. There's schools that really don't emphasize meditation at all, that just do a lot of chanting. There's schools that have gone kind of a really, like a more supernatural direction, where they see Buddha as kind of a celestial being who can come down and help you if you call to him and practice that way. So I don't know if I would say that meditation was Buddha's main focus, but it was certainly one of his main focuses. And I think it's also fair to say it's his origin. So he wouldn't be the Buddha without that experience of awakening, and he wouldn't have that experience of awakening without meditation. So you can't really tell Buddha's story without talking about meditation. And so it's certainly there. But there's a lot else there too.
Okay, for your talk, going back to just what you said is about meditation, and also the correlation I tend to use a lot is that we understand organs of our body, and through observation and history of doing that, we know, for example, that it's good to have certain things to eat, like probiotics or something like that, right? So we know that from analysis, I suppose, and methods. The difference seems to me is that, as this correlation, is that we all share this same organ. But the organ is looking at the organ. And that's the difference, it seems to me. It's still evolving, this idea I have. So the way it seems like that's being done is not a narrative, maybe not, I should say. But the main thing, it seems to me, that most people that do this practice, at least here in this Zendo and a few other ones, at the heart of it is sitting in silence, stillness, as you described it initially today, with form. So that I think is vital. It's the heart. But what, on that same note, though, what seems to be really important to me to address is our nature. This is an investigation of our nature, really, which is can be put into a story, which we do, but it's more than that. And being, as you are, a parent, one of the things I recognized is seems to me one of the most two hardwired parts of our nature is one of a just incredibly beautiful nurturing. Like we're all mothers. Mm. There was a video I saw, it might have been the Dalai Lama, I can't remember, I brought it up before, of a one-year-old in a group of one-year-olds. And one of them falls down, and just immediately all these other nine come over and console this other one-year-old. 1 hour later, they're hitting each other. And somebody has to intervene because they can do. So this violence, this hatred, this anger, this violent, this incredible thing that we witness now has been going on since time immemorial. And just recently, I'll just end that, is that on this other Zendo, this one guy was talking about that these two hardwired veins of us is our evolution, that they're intertwined. So I'm just, you to say that.
You know, people sometimes ask me, thank you. Yeah, how has meditation affected my beliefs? And you know, you talked about these organs of the body. I think about meditation as a little bit like a microscope or a telescope. You know, which allow us to see the world a little more clearly. So, for example, now we all know that our bodies are made up of these cells, and all these millions of microscopic cells. They always were made up of that, but for thousands and thousands of years, people didn't know that. They learned that when they got a microscope that allowed them to see it more clearly. Or Buddha tells this example of seeing this morning star and being awakened. And the morning star is real. You can see it if you go out early in the morning. But the thing is, it's not a star, which we know because now we have telescopes and we can see that it's a planet. So it was always there. It's a real thing, but it's not what it seems. And I think meditation helps us in the same way. It's not that we don't exist. It's not that suffering doesn't exist. It's not, none of this stuff is an illusion exactly. We're not living in the matrix. The stuff is real, but it's not what it seems. And through meditation, we can see it more clearly and understand what it really is. And through that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.